And so the babe grew up a pretty boy, but most unteachable, and never learnt a prayer, nor told a bead, but knew the names of birds, and mocked their notes, and whistled, as he were a bird himself. Welcome to Sunday Morning Poetry on the Troubadour Podcast. Today, we are going to cover The Foster Mother's Tale, a dramatic fragment by Samuel Taylor Coleridge in the 1798 Lyrical Ballads. Now, we've been going through this 1798 Lyrical Ballads, and I skipped The Foster Mother's Tale for a particular reason. I wanted to focus a little bit on Wordsworth. Now, in this tale, it is a dramatic fragment. So it is from a play that Coleridge wrote, and he honed it for the Lyrical Ballads. Now, what's interesting is that the people in 1798 did not have the play to read. The play was not published for a couple decades after this. So, but he knew that, of course, and he and Wordsworth, you know, cut out a specific chunk and made it in a context that was able to have a certain impact on the reader. Poets are very interested in, or should be very interested in, the impact that the words in the order that they have will have on the reader. Now, so we're going to talk about that from the perspective of the 1798 version, which or the 1798 reader. And then I'll give you a little bit of context. So I'm going to approach this in two ways. One, we're going to have the Foster Mother's Tale, and we're going to have the fragment, and I'm just going to give it to you, and we'll discuss it and analyze it from the perspective of a 1798 person, right, who was reading this and not knowing anything about the play, which I'll tell you about later. And then I'll tell you about Coleridge's play and what role this played in that. And that will reveal a little bit of, what's behind this poem. But before we do, it's important that we talk a little bit about education. Now, we're not going to go into the full theory of education. There's so much that we can talk about. But I want to talk about one particular aspect of education, which is the amount of social and moralizing viewpoints and opinions that should be impinged or thrown on children. So I'm going to build quickly two models for this, two extreme models, neither of which I advocate in and of themselves, but that I think are representative and interesting to think about when we are considering, contemplating, constructing an education system for our most cherished children. So first, let me read you a passage from one of my favorite books of all time, nonfiction books of all time, is The Gift of Fire by Richard Mitchell. And this is the story of Petronilla. So here's the story. It's a story about Petronilla, who was the daughter of Saint Peter. Okay, here we go. Saint Peter, the tale tells, had only and much beloved daughter named Petronilla. Peter knew all too well the wicked ways of the world and the terrible temptations it had to offer, especially to attractive young girls. He wanted, as we all do, to keep his daughter safe, lest she fall into any badness, and thus, I suppose, also to keep her happy, for badness is a notorious provider of unhappiness. He was a man of considerable and very unusual powers, so he brought upon the girl a deep slumber, almost like that of death itself. And so she slept her young years away, safe from the world and its wickedness. Peter's friends, however, knew only that the girl was always unconscious, like one deathly ill. One day, when some of them came to visit and chat with the great man, one of them said, "Peter, we find one thing hard to understand. We have seen you work wonders with the sick and even those at the very door of death. How is it then that you seem to be able to do nothing for your own daughter, your own child, your lovely daughter, who lies as one dead in the next room and has so lain for years?" Ah, oh, my friends, said Peter. You misunderstand. Petronilla is not sick at all. She sleeps, and I have provided her the safe haven of the sleep. Thus she will escape that which so threatens, and often undoes even the best of mortals, the corrupting influence of this world and its ways. She is far from sick. She is well in virtue, and sleeps exactly as I want her to sleep. Here, let me show you that what I say is true. And he called the girl to awaken, and she awoke. Come, said her father, and meet my friends. Bring them food and drink, that we may be joyful together. And she brought them food and drink. And St. Peter's friends found the girl just as he had said, pure and good and gracious in every way, and uncorrupted by the world. And when she had done all that was asked of her, her father sent her back to bed. Sleep now, Petronilla, he said, and she slept. That's one of my favorite stories, he says. This is Richard Mitchell. It provokes endless thought, all of it fruitful, but unfortunately a bit facetious. Now, before I read this last little couple sentences, I wanted to just set that up. That's the story of Petronilla. The story is similar to Cinderella, except that it's explicitly about child rearing and education, right? So one way to educate the child from a moral standpoint or from the social ill standpoint is to have them just be completely asleep, right? So you have them completely dead asleep so that they don't know anything about what's going on outside the world of whatever framework of education, of knowledge that you want them to have. Now, what's the other view? Well, if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you'll see a young lady pop up on screen. And that will be Greta Thunberg. Now, Greta Thunberg to me is the absolute opposite of Petronilla. Now, so you have Petronilla on one end of the spectrum, Greta Thunberg on the next. Now, if you don't know, Greta Thunberg is a child activist. She gave a speech in September 23rd, 2019. I'm doing this podcast just two or three days later. Today's the 26th. So now Greta went to the UN and berated them in very high moralistic terms using the how dare you and finger wagging and you're destroying my dreams. Now, she used no facts. She used no evidence. She gave no arguments. She's merely said, you are doing horrible things. You're destroying me. How dare you? You're cowards. Very moral terminology, right? And anybody who's ever listened to a young Christian person or any Christian person who has the idea that, you know, being gay is wrong or any of these things, they don't have any evidence for it of why it's immoral. They just say it is. That is one extreme. Now, whether she's right or wrong is actually something that is a separate issue. If you want to know more about it, you can go to a podcast I recommend called The Power Hour with Alex Epstein. Those guys actually read the IPCC report that Thunberg is referring to. They discuss the scientific claims that she, you know, doesn't even really bring up. She just does what's called in logic a call to authority. Just says, well, this is the way it's been done. But that's a slightly different subject that we might touch on. And the important thing is, you know, these two, Petronilla versus Greta Thunberg, and the Parkland activists too, like the anti-gun activists. These are 14, 15, 16 year olds who have these high ideals and morals. They've solidly had this information. They know it's right. There's no way that they could ever have any kind of even discussion about them, right? So that is one end of the spectrum in terms of educating a child. And here's what Richard Mitchell says. We don't educate children that way anymore, like Petronilla, by protecting them completely, almost to the extent of having them be asleep. We don't educate children that way anymore, but we have gone to the opposite and equally ludicrous extreme. We don't let them get any sleep at all. Even as tiny tykes, they are led to worry about any and every great social issue, from abortion to nuclear war, and cajoled into believing that they have done something about such matters once they have expressed themselves. Their geography books require them to speculate as to what they would do to put an end to poverty in South America, and their civics books call on them to imagine a solution to the problem of toxic waste, which requires nothing more than the miraculous appearance of some currently unknown technology. That's exactly what Greta Thunberg is doing, by the way. Now, let me make a very bold claim that you may not agree with, but this is something I actually do agree with. Let us say that the world is going to end, and we know for a fact that what she is saying, or it's not going to necessarily end. Let's say that what Greta Thunberg is saying is true. Let's just assume that. Let's say that mass extinction is already starting, that it's, you know, we need to hit the brakes super hard, that, you know, there's going to be new super tornadoes and malaria viruses that grow and that we can't stop, and that the sea level is going to rise so much that Manhattan will be underwater and people are going to starve to death and it's going to be horrible. Let's say that that's true. Here's my argument, my viewpoint, very adamantly, that children should not be aware of that. They shouldn't even know that that's a possibility. As far as they know, they should live in a kind of paradise that's focused on learning certain facts and knowledge and information that they need. And in my view of education, it should be much more limited in what they are learning. I think we teach them probably, or we shove so much stuff down their faces that it's probably 100 times more than they need. You know, like I would be fine with like a education that had like focused on really studying 5 or 6 literature stories, some poetry, the basics of science and arithmetic, and that's it. And what very basic though, like very, very basic all the way up until 15 and now maybe 16. And then you can kind of learn a little bit about what's going on in the world. So in other words, I advocate personally a kind of protectionist bubble for these children. Even if Greta Thunberg is correct and the world is coming to an end, even if their adulthood's going to be terrible because of this lack of, because of our failure, even if that's the case, I still believe that they should not even be aware of that. And the reason is because they're children. That's it. That's the argument. There's only one childhood, only one biological childhood. You're only 0 to 15 once. Once you're over 15 and you've matured, at least biologically, everything's different. And that's a whole nother developmental thing, but you've gone through that phase. That developmental phase in human existence is unique, and it's a one that should be carefree and should be not burdened by all the social ills. So it's, to me, completely abhorrent and grotesque that Thunberg and the Parkland shooters and all these child activists are even aware of these situations. And let me give you an extreme example, another one. In the Cold War, they would show these videos to children of a nuclear bomb and then what to do, hide under your desk. I believe they should not have even shown those. I believe it would have been better to let the kids die unaware of what was going to happen than to destroy the childhood of all those kids. Let me repeat that. I believe it is better to have let those children die than to have destroyed their childhood. Now, by the way, I in the nuclear example, the hiding under your desk is not really going to do much for the kids that would have died anyway. Right. So the kids that would have died. And so I believe the same thing about, school shooters. We should not be focusing on school shooters and how to deal with it and what to do. We should completely ignore it and just live and protect them from knowing about those things. Because you, even if the kid is to die, that's how extreme I am about it. Because not that I want that, but the reason is because you only get those things once. And what you get is a kind of tyrannical monster that comes out of that, and that they have no enjoyment of their childhood. There's a reason why there's an untold amount of anxiety amongst children. Now, why is this relevant, you might be thinking? Well, this is very relevant to the story in Foster Mother's Tale, and an important theme that runs throughout Lyrical Ballads, which is education. And why to educate? Where does corrupting influence come from? And these Romantic poets were heavily influenced by Samuel Godwin, who believed very vehemently in the Petronilla viewpoint. His view, and he viewed, by the way, Samuel Godwin was a philosopher who married a woman named Mary Wollstonecraft, who they, the two of them, had a child named Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, who married Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, the daughter, married a young poet named Percy Shelley. And she changed her name to Mary Shelley. And when she was 18, 19, she wrote a book called Frankenstein, which is the first science fiction book because it deals explicitly with knowledge and education. That's what science fiction deals with, particularly knowledge, not science, knowledge, and the acquisition of it and how we should acquire it and what to do with it and where it comes from. Okay, so Godwin had that view of the Petronilla view. And he was so extreme, he believed he could literally train a genius. That he thought he could make a genius. He thought he could make a genius. And the reason is he didn't believe that ability was innate at all. He believed that there was zero innate ability, that we all had, that all bad things happen because of bad education. Now, by the way, I don't fully agree with that, but you know, I do believe a lot of bad things happen because, but not 100% like he did. So just to give you an example, he believed that to train a genius, you have to train them in how to use their own senses for themselves and how to integrate them for themselves. It was a very romantic idea of the 19th century. And his proposition was to put a newborn infant in a gray room with no windows, to raise that infant in that gray room, to give it food in a very particular environment, to wear plain clothes, to only touch it in particular ways, to develop its senses one step at a time. So he had this weird view of, touching its palms, right? And that's how you start the kind of sensory apparatus. And then you bring in colors one at a time because he was worried about the overload. And that's what he thought destroyed genius. Now, of course, that's not true. I think that's crazy. You know, that's why I used Petronilla versus Greta Thunberg as two polar examples, but it gives you an idea of what, you know, how do you frame these, this idea of what to teach and educate your children with? So there's those two ideas, right? In my view, I am much more closer related to the Petronilla view. I think that's extreme, but I would, you know, I think kids are taught 90% of things that, one, they don't remember, but two, that the residue it leaves is disgusting. And you see that residue, the slime coming out in the faces and the anger and the, you know, unknowable fear that these children are facing, which I think is a tragedy to the nth degree. It's horrible. And so in the lyrical ballads, we get a new, or we get a different approach to it. We get a somewhat Godwinian, but it's also impacted and influenced by Coleridge and Wordsworth's view of education. So you get Nightingale, Expostulation and Reply, and several other poems, this view of nature being the way to educate and rear a child. And you also get that a little bit in Frankenstein. And, you know, this is a very heavy theme at this era of the world. And a lot of it comes, you know, from Godwin, and some of it comes from Rousseau, who believed in similar things, that, you know, that the education system is what, the certain kinds of books that we give kids, that's the big problem that we have. Is that it's kind of training them. And it's training them in a way that makes them kind of like Greta Thunberg. Okay, so thank you for your patience in that setup. I know that was a big setup, but I think it's going to be helpful for this poem in particular and in many poems. So what we're going to do is, again, I'm going to read to you the foster mother's tale, a dramatic fragment, in the way that they would have experienced it in 1798. And then, you know, I'll give you some of the context and we'll explore it. Explore the context that way so that you have an idea of what's happening with it. Okay. So let's, where the context is for this and in the play and what role this segment has, this fragment. But let's go into The Foster Mother's Tale, a dramatic fragment by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now I'm going to read, for those of you only listening, you'll hear me say foster mother, and then I'll read the line. And Maria is the foster mother's daughter. So that's the context that we do have in this play or in this dramatic fragment. is that it's a foster mother talking to her foster daughter, Maria. Okay. Foster mother. I never saw the man whom you describe. Maria. 'Tis strange. He speak of you familiarly as mine and Albert's common foster mother. Foster mother. Now blessings on the man, whoever he be, that joined your names with mine. O my sweet lady, as often as I think of those dear times, when you two little ones would stand at eve on each side of my chair and make me learn all you had learnt in the day, and how to talk in gentle phrase, then bid me sing to you. 'Tis more like heaven to come than what has been. Maria. Oh, my dear mother, this strange man has left me troubled with wilder fancies than the moon breeds in the lovesick maid who gazes at it. Till lost in inward vision, with wet eye, she gazes idly. But that entrance, mother. Foster mother. Can no one hear? It is a perilous tale. Maria. No one. Foster mother. My husband's father told it me. Poor old Leone. Angels rest his soul. He was a woodman, and could fell and saw with lusty arm. You know that huge round beam which props the hanging wall of the old chapel? Beneath that tree, while yet it was a tree, he found a baby wrapped in mosses, lined with thistle beards, and such small locks of wool as hang on brambles. Well, he brought him home, and reared him at the then Lord Valles's cost. And so the babe grew up a pretty boy, but most unteachable, and never learnt a prayer, nor told a bead, but knew the names of birds, and mocked their notes, and whistled as he were a bird himself. And all the autumn 'twas his only play to get the seeds of wildflowers, and to plant them with earth and water on the stumps of trees. A friar, who gathered simples in the wood, a gray-haired man, he loved this little boy. The boy loved him. And when the friar taught him, he soon could write with the pen, and from that time lived chiefly at the convent or the castle. So he became a very learned youth. But oh, poor wretch! He read and read and read till his brain turned, and ere his 20th year he had unlawful thoughts of many things. And though he prayed, he never loved to pray with holy men nor in a holy place. But yet his speech, it was so soft and sweet, the late Lord Valles ne'er was wearied with him. And once, as by the north side of the chapel, they stood together, chained in deep discourse. The earth heaved under them with such a groan that the wall tottered and had well nigh fallen right on their heads. My lord was sorely frightened. A fever seized him, and he made a confession of all the heretical and lawless talk which brought this judgment. So the youth was seized and cast into that hole. My husband's father sobbed like a child. It almost broke his heart. And once, as he was working in the cellar, he heard a voice distinctly. 'Twas the youths who sung a doleful song about green fields. How sweet it were on lake or wild savanna to hunt for food and be a naked man and wander up and down at liberty. He always doted on the youth, and now his love grew desperate, and defying death, he made that cunning entrance I described, and the young man escaped. Maria, 'tis a sweet tale, such as would lull a listening child to sleep, his rosy face besoiled with unwiped tears. And what became of him? Foster mother. He went on shipboard with those bold voyagers who made discovery of golden lands. Leone's younger brother went likewise, And when he returned to Spain, he told Leone that the poor, mad youth, soon after they arrived in the New World, in spite of his dissuasion, seized a boat, and all alone, set sail by silent moonlight up a great river, great as any sea, and ne'er was heard of more. But 'tis supposed he lived and died among the savage men. Okay, so that is the Foster Mother's Tale, a dramatic fragment. Now, let's go through this a little bit and kind of explore what's going on. Now, of course, as I always say, you're not going to understand this from a first reading. If you do, then wow, you are amazing. And this is, this is a challenging one, not just because of the language, which isn't that complicated when you really look at it, but that it's a fragment. So it starts off by a foster mother saying almost mid-sentence or mid-conversation, "I never saw the man whom you describe." So the Maria, her daughter, stepdaughter, describes some kind of man, right? And she says, "Well, that's strange. He spoke of you familiarly. So this man that I described to you said something about, you. He knew you very well. And he said, oh, yeah, you as mine and were mine and Albert's common foster mother." So right here, we have a setup that we have Maria and we have some characters that we don't know of. Albert, for instance. Albert is Maria's foster brother. And, this mother is the foster mother. And then there's some man, mysterious man who we don't know. You can think of this. That's part of why it's a dramatic fragment. Is you can kind of think, who did she describe and why was he telling Maria about their family? And now that's going to lead into this kind of really bizarre tale. Now the foster mother says, well, then he is a blessed man. Now blessings on the man, whoever he be, that joined your names with mine. Now, so, who joined your names with mine, who kind of confirmed who we all were. And, we can say maybe there's something in the play which I haven't actually read. I've read about it to give you some context, but I'm planning on reading it. It's on the list now. And the play, by the way, I'll just give you the name now, is called Osario. O-S-O-R-I-O. Osario. And then the foster mother continues, "Oh, my sweet lady, as often as I think of those dear times when you two little ones would stand at eve on each side of my chair and make me learn all you had learned in the day." So she's saying kind of this guy is sweet and, for naming us. And then she says to her daughter, "Oh, my sweet lady, I think of those times as often as I think of those dear times when Albert, the brother, and Maria sat and taught to the foster mother what she had learned." Now, by the way, those of you who have read Frankenstein might find this little cottage life familiar. There's a view of this and Mary Shelley is definitely getting this from Coleridge to some degree, especially the relationship between the brother and sister. This is an important viewpoint that he had and that Mary Shelley's mother also wrote about. Okay, so, the mother is saying, "I remember you standing by my chair and you and your brother telling me all that you had learned in the day. And I remember how to talk in gentle phrase, then bid me sing to you. 'Tis more like heaven to come than what has been." So she's basically saying, "I remember this very fondly. And then you would, after you would teach me what you learned in the day, I would then sing to you." Right? And it was like a heavenly time. And now Maria goes on and says, "Oh, my dear mother, this strange man has left me troubled with wilder fancies than the moon breathes in the lovesick maid who gazes at it, till lost in inward vision with wet eye she gazes idly." Now, that is a strange thing to say. We're talking about her brother and her brother. And the familiar man, all we know is that he told her about her brother, right? And so in telling her about her brother and her mother, Maria feels a strangeness stir in her. "This strange man has left me troubled with wild fancies," right? Wilder fancies, wilder even than the moon that breeds in the lovesick maid. So she's now, the connotate or the comparison is between her and a lovesick maid. Now, we're talking about her brother. So wait a second. What are we talking about here? Now, it's her foster brother. Right? So it's her stepbrother. So, you know, is that immoral? Like, I don't know. Is she having sexual fantasies about him? Right? Like, she's a lovesick maid who gazes at the moon until she's lost in an inward vision. Right? What kind of inward vision? I don't know. Just contemplative one about her brother. Possibly. Maybe a fantasy about her brother. And she has wet eye. Right? And so, what we talk about, you know, that's probably crying. You know, we could just keep it clean like that, which I think is probably what it means, but it could connote other things. With wet eyes, she gazes idly, right? And this is the, but there's, you know, the reason I'm bringing it up almost in a sexual connotation is maids who look at the moon and have a sadness have often been, you know, that's a lover's view. That's the view and the image that you have of sexual partners, right? Wordsworth in this same lyrical ballads has some poems about that, about the moon and two lovers. And then she says, but that entrance, mother. And now I don't know what they're talking about with that entrance. That's very vague. What entrance? Is it the entrance of some, pit or some, maybe forbidden place? Like, is it a forbidden land, an entrance to a forbidden land that you're not supposed to go to? What is it? So, the mother then decides to tell her a tale. Can no one hear? It is a perilous tale. So we have this daughter, Maria, who's been infected with a view from this man, or she, the man telling her about her stepbrother brings to her mind some kind of love, you know, the feeling of a lovesick maid. And then she says, but that entrance, you know, I take this as possibly the entrance to some kind of palace of love, a forbidden palace, right? That's the almost incestuous. So in order to kind of help her daughter, to educate, to rear, to give guidance to her daughter, her foster daughter, the foster mother says something. She says, can no one hear? It is a perilous tale. And this is in response supposedly to that entrance, you know, but that entrance, mother, can no one hear the entrance? What is a perilous tale? Now, it's a little vague, but I think we're going to hear a little bit about what that means. And Maria says, no one can hear it, right? No one can hear it. Maybe no one can know about it, right? Because it's not proper. It's taboo. So the foster mother says, my husband's father told it to me, poor old Leonie. So the foster mother's telling a story that her husband's father had told her. Now, again, if you know Frankenstein and the cottage, you'll know that there's like an old man who's blind. He's telling all these stories to these kids, right? That's a part of it anyway. My husband's father told this story to me. His name, poor old Leonie, or he's Leonie. Angels rest his soul. So the husband's father, Leonie, told this story to her, the now foster mother, and he's dead. Now, Leonie was a woodman, and he could fell and saw with lusty arms. He was this very strong woodman. He's a man of nature, right? He's a man who lives in nature, but he's also a man who cuts down nature, right? So he's not maybe fully integrated with nature, perhaps. You know that huge round beam which props the hanging wall of the old chapel? She asks his daughter. She answers the question, she doesn't let the daughter answer. She just assumes, you know, if this is on stage, maybe the daughter would nod her head or something. Well, beneath that tree, while yet it was a tree, Leonie found a baby wrapped in mosses, lined with thistle beards, like different types of flowers. Well, he brought him home. So this Leonie guy finds a baby wrapped in moss, right? So, you know, lots of stories of, I mean, think of Rudyard Kipling, stories of the Jungle Book and like, Tarzan, these babies left in the wild. And Frankenstein is a kind of monstrous version of that, right? Of a baby that's left to its own devices in nature, in the wild, a feral child. So he finds this feral child wrapped in mosses, lined with thistle beards, and such small locks of wool as hang on brambles. And then Leone, while he brought him home and reared him at the then Lord Valis's cost. So he, the lord of this castle, this area that they live in, this region, who owns this area, right? It's a peasant. This is a couple generations prior to 1798. So this is, you know, we could say in a more feudal era. So this, he owns this and the lord has to pay for it. And so the babe grew up a pretty boy, but most unteachable. So this is a boy who was, you know, started his life as a feral baby, you know, in nature, and he's unteachable. But by teach, they mean, and never learnt a prayer, right? By the church, the moralizing of the church, nor told a bead, but knew the names of birds. So he, you know, bead are like I take it to be some kind of stories of the church, and I'm not exactly sure how that worked, but I'm taking those as the moral stories of the church. But what he did know, so he was unteachable in the moralizing of the church, the Greta Thunberg model. He was unteachable in those things. It just did not stick. So you could teach him about nuclear war. It didn't stick. You could teach him about all the abortion problems. Didn't stick. Climate change is going to kill everybody. None of that stuck. But he knew the names of birds and mocked their notes. Now, not mock in the sense of make fun of, but mocked in the sense of emulate, right? They would hear a chirp, 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 and he'd go chirp, chirp, chirp. Like he was just like a little bird. He was a natural being, one with nature, and whistled as he were a bird himself, right? One with nature. And all the autumn, 'twas his only play to get the seeds of wildflowers and to plant them with earth and water on the stumps of trees. So unlike the woodman Leone who found him, who cut down trees, this young child plants trees, right? So we have a contrast here. So we have these two people. One is the man who cuts down trees, and he's, you know, he is unable to teach prayers and moral stories from the church. And we have this feral child who is the opposite of that, right? Who's in nature, and he emulates birds, and he plants plants trees. This is The Jungle Book. This is Frankenstein. I mean, this is every one of those feral child Tarzan stories, right? Okay. And by the way, this is where it comes from. There's none of this before in literature. This is the start of it, is the Romantics. The Romantics, in my view, started like pretty much everything in terms of great stories. Continuing. Now, a friar. Now, not a priest. A friar is a monk, basically, who would maybe be in charge of some small little church or church area in a small town, a friar who gathered simples in the wood. Now, simples in the wood is from Shakespeare, and it means medicinal herbs, right? So Shakespeare quoted or phrased the term simples in the wood, I believe in Macbeth, where they're going and they're getting medicinal herbs and they're getting simples in the wood. So this friar is gathering medicinal herbs. So we have another character who is unlike the woodman. He's not a priest necessarily, but he is kind of maybe a combination, and he grabs, you know, he's using nature for his own purposes is one way to look at that. He's a gray-haired man, and he loved this little boy, right? The little boy that mocked the birds, that was a bird. The boy loved him. And when the friar taught him, he soon could write with the pen, so the little boy could now write. And from that time, lived chiefly at the convent or the castle. So now the boy is being reared by the state and the church, convent or the castle. So he became a very learned youth, right? So now we had the natural learnings that he had of just nature versus the book learnings. Oh, poor wretch. He read and read and read till his brain turned. Now, I want to emphasize, because I've had this conversation with objectivists and people who are, like me, very pro-books, right? I'm very pro-books, but I want to stress that I don't, you know, this is a kind of contradiction in the Coleridge and Wordsworth viewpoint, for sure, where they were against reading to a certain extent. They were not against reading as such, necessarily, but this was, there were lots of books and things being published, you know, especially post-Gutenberg, that was similar to being against your kid looking on media all day long on their phones and their laptops and their tablets. This is how they looked at it, is like, that's the equivalent in my mind. It's not necessarily don't read any great books. Like they would have been, you know, like Frankenstein reads Plutarch and he reads Milton and I can't remember the philosopher that he read. So there's certain works that, you know, vetted to a proper standard should be read, but not reading everything. It's the same thing as, you know, watching everything on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and just getting all your information and experiences of the world through those mediums. That this kind of bald reading of just anything was a negative thing. Now, they in their poetry, they do equate it to just reading in general, but they didn't advocate for that because there were often times when they would say reading is good, and they were both huge readers, like massive readers. They read and read and read. They were brilliant human beings. So, you know, but their view of the early years, just like my view of, I think I'd be closer, you know, to the Petronella view, where I would think, you know, just get them a few good classic literature, teach it to them, even if it takes a couple of years. Like, I don't care, you know, in terms of that. Like, I'm advocate of much less schooling than people get. And I think they should be done by 15. So less hours, less days of the week, all year round, and just get it done. Reading several books over a long period of time. They can read other fun things that are children's lit on their own. You know, that's a different discussion. But anyway, but that's kind of, I think, what they're getting at here. Till his brain turned, right? And continued. And before and ere his 20th year, he had unlawful thoughts of many things. Now that's important thought. And words are important in poetry and in life. It's not immoral thoughts. It's unlawful thoughts, which means thoughts that are not accepted by society. And though he prayed, he never loved to pray with holy men, nor in a holy place. But yet his speech, it was so soft and sweet. The late Lord Valez, so we learn that Valez has died since, never was wearied with him. And once, so this is where things change. And once, as by the north, they're sitting by the north side of the chapel, and they stood together. And they were chained, and that's a good word that they're using here, chained in deep discourse. They were united as a chain. And then there was some kind of earth heaved under them with such a groan, right? So it was an earthquake, let's say, that the wall tottered and had well nigh fallen right on their heads. So they almost killed by this wall that's beside them. My lord, Lord Valez, who's now dead, my lord was sorely frightened. A fever seized him, and he made confession of all the heretical and lawless talk which brought this judgment. Now, the judgment, by the way, just for grammatical purposes, when you see something like this, this is a clause in and of itself, which brought this judgment. Which judgment? The judgment that's going to come after this colon. So the youth was... So it's actually not really exactly expressed. It's kind of implied in this particular sentence. But it's the unlawful thoughts that the kid had. So the infant that was wrapped in moss, the feral child, had unlawful thoughts. The Lord was okay with those unlawful thoughts. They had a discussion. But then something happened to the Lord. He almost died, right? So he had a crisis of faith, usually. And maybe he didn't want to go to hell. So he confessed. Now he confessed and he said everything that happened that they talked about. All the heretical and lawless talk. So this kid, who was now educated from nature, but also is a learned youth, there was a judgment brought on him, and the youth was seized and cast into a hole, right, as punishment. My husband's father sobbed like a child. That's Leone for this. So the one who found the child sobbed like a child. It almost broke his heart. And once he was working in the cellar, he heard a voice distinctly. Twas the youth's. So the feral child is singing, and he's still trying to hold on to his spirit. He has a spirit. He's singing in this dirty, dark hole. Who sung doleful song about green fields. So he's singing about green fields, how sweet it were on a lake or wild savannah. He's, you know, treeless plain, lakes, like laying out and kind of experiencing and enjoying his, you know, life, he's singing about what it feels like just to hunt for food and be a naked man. So to have none of the trappings of society and nature or of civilization and wander up and down at liberty, you know, to do whatever you want. He always doted on the youth. And now, this is Leone always doted on the youth. And now Dione's love grew desperate. And defying death, so to save this kid, he made that cunning entrance I described. Oh, so here we go. So when they described the, and the young man escaped, by the way. So when we talked about, let me go back up here. But that entrance, mother, that makes a little bit more sense now, doesn't it? So Maria talked about that entrance. So we know we're missing information from this play because it's a dramatic fragment. So apparently her mother mentioned an entrance to a dark hole. Now, this will become clear in a little bit when I talk about Osario, the play. But just keep that in mind that we have this entrance that the mother is now saying, and defying death, Leone made that cunning, he made an entrance. So he made an entrance into this hole. This hole is where you put unlawful people who are heretics, and the young man was able to escape. So that's critical to know that if you want to understand the Osario play that I'll talk to you about in a minute. But the point is that the foster mother told this tale of this feral young child who was educated and moralized in the way of society. And then he still has his old thoughts. He's thrown in jail for not having the right thoughts. And then he still sings of this, you know, this world of nature and living as one with nature. Maria says, 'tis a sweet tale, such as would lull a listening child to sleep. As what other tales do that? Moral tales, Aesop's tales, fairy tales. So it's a fairy tale, right? By the way, I think Frankenstein is a fairy tale. Right? The Frankenstein story, it's if you know the story of Frankenstein, it's Victor Frankenstein on the boat of Robert Walton, who's going after basically Hyperborea, which is this view of the North Pole, that if you go past a certain point, there's this beautiful, you know, perfect paradise, like the Garden of Eden is up there. He actually believes that, and he's going to go there. And he runs into this other wild man who has a wild view, and he's going to usurp all of society and community in order to get it. And Victor had accidentally, in his pursuits, created a monster. And he's chasing him. And he tells Walton the story of this monster and what happens. And that's the fairy tale. So Victor Frankenstein is telling a fairy tale to Robert Walton. And it's, what are fairy tales supposed to do? They're supposed to educate, to moralize, to train young children a certain way. So this foster mother is telling Maria a fairy tale that's supposed to train her about something. And now Maria asks, well, what happened to him? His rosy face soiled with unwiped tears, and what became of him? Foster mother. So she says, well, he went on a shipboard with those bold voyagers. He went on with some brave voyagers who would go into far distant lands that nobody knows about, like, you know, Robert Walton from Frankenstein. And they made discovery of golden lands. So there's a view. There's always been a view until recently, really, that there's some kind of gold land out there. We just don't know where it is, right? We just have to map it out. And maybe we'll find it. And that's what spurred a lot of people into travel like that and into exploration in the age of exploration. So he goes on this place to on the ship to Golden Lands. Leone's younger brother went likewise. And when he returned to Spain, he told Leone that the poor mad youth, soon after they arrived in that new world, maybe it was America, in spite of his discussion, seized a boat and all alone set, or some America. So they go to this place, and the young boy goes to this weird land, this new strange land. And he seizes a boat and all alone set sail by silent moonlight. So we have that moonlight again. So he's out there. It's just him, the boat, and the moonlight. He goes up a great river. Who knows? Mississippi? I don't know. Like I said, I haven't read Osario, so I don't have enough information. And the river's great as any sea. Maybe it's the Amazon. And as any sea, and never was heard of more. But it is supposed he lived and died among the savage men. So what's the story structured out really quickly of the foster mother's fairy tale? So Leone, a woodman, who cuts down trees, finds a feral child, feral baby, young child. This young child is unteachable, but he is very in tuned with nature. He's very able to be, taught by nature. Then eventually he is educated and becomes a learned youth by reading. And then one day he and the Lord of that era are having a discussion of all the unlawful thoughts. These are, taboos. One taboo could be incest with your sister, by the way. That could be one of them, but it could be a whole number of things that you could have with it. And, you're just not supposed to do. And so when this near-death experience happened to the Lord revealed his secrets of these, incestuous or whatever taboo things, this heretical views, maybe that there's no God is one of them. And then you have him being arrested. He's thrown in a hole. In that hole, he sings, and Leone hears him, digs an entrance, helps the boy escape, and then the boy goes off on a boat to find golden lands. And then when he's there, instead of, going back home to Spain like his friend, he stays there, goes on a boat, and it's supposed that he ends up with strange men. Like, we could think of wild men who just live out with animals. Okay, so that's the foster mother's tale. Now, it might sound bizarre, right? And it is bizarre, because what's going on? So one thing is, I tried to give you some indication of how to use, even as a fragment, what's going on in there. So the questions that maybe will pop up in your mind are, what is Maria, what is her relationship to Albert? Why was Albert mentioned? What's going on with that? Why did the foster mother feel it's important to tell Maria about this man who said, forget moral, the morals of the community, and went out on his own? Why did the foster mother feel that that was an important tale to tell to Maria? Right? And because Maria is thinking about her brother in a romantic light, as we've seen. And she's thinking about this entrance, right? So we get this indication that maybe there's someone else in that hole. Okay, so we have that hole, and we know that Leone dug an entrance to that hole. And so there may be a way to get in there. And there's myths about this, with Theseus and the Minotaur and Ariadne, who helps him with her string, but there's this idea of, she has the way out for this person. Now, the only other person we have at this point is Albert. So that's the only other person we know of. So maybe there's something wrong with Albert. And maybe the foster mother is telling her the story of a man who has absconded from the morality of the community, in order to encourage Maria to go to that hole, to that entrance. But that entrance, as she says, can no one hear it? And she says, no one. Maybe Maria's not ready to hear the tale. Maybe Maria's not ready to hear about her own incestuous love with her brother. Maybe she's not ready to go and to the entrance dug by Leone and take whoever is in that hole out of there. And maybe if that's her brother, she's worried about it. So we don't know. It's all a dramatic fragment, right? We just don't have enough information, but we know some of that information, and it's worth thinking about. And then the fairy tale is in and of itself worth thinking about, right? So we know about this guy who went through that experience that I was talking about. Maria says it's a sweet tale, and she wants to know, what became of him. And then the mother tells her. And then the question is, what does Maria do next? Okay, let me give you just a little bit of context about this poem. So, I could be wrong, but I believe what I read in the poem, the dramatic fragment, is correct, in that Osorio is understandable, even if you don't read Osorio. So I think it's vaguely there if you look at it. However, I did have a hint by knowing a little bit about the poem, the play Osorio, where indeed the Albert character is in a hole, and Maria has to go rescue him. And that's actually what this is in the fourth act, that this goes on in this play. And Maria does, in fact, do that. So, I think I have that maybe bias that maybe indicated something about, that kind of spoiled it for me a little bit. But I do think it's there, even if you don't know that part of the story. So the question is, in a broader tale about education, how do we rear our children? How much should we tell? Did the foster mother, you know, give the right indication by also indicating, or by indicating in this story, that the teachings of man, the teachings of our community and civilization may not be the best, that it may be better. Maybe it's not definitive in this particular poem, but maybe better just to go on a boat in the moonlight and go live with strange men by yourself. And I do think that this is something that we should, at least as a modern society, contemplate. Like, maybe it is better to be a hermit, to stay away from society. You know, when does society become so overburdening, so anxiety ridden, that all the benefits of the life-saving, you know, drugs and technology just become not moot, that aren't the best? At what point? I don't think we're there. I don't think we're even close to there. But I do think there's a point where it's like society is so horrible, right? Like, if you're living in a true totalitarian society, where they can, you know, by totalitarian, they meant total control over your entire life. I think in that society, for sure, it's much superior to live outside of it. But, you know, everybody might be a little bit different. And there is something to consider about, when is that the case? And when should you abscond? Also, when should you rebel against the morals of the community and instead follow your own edicts? And of course, the edicts that they have here in this poem comes from a teaching and a learning from nature, from looking out in your own senses and developing your senses for yourself, which allows you to think for yourself. Okay, so we're going to return to this nature and education theme as we continue through Lyrical Ballads, because it is a critical one throughout all of Lyrical Ballads. But I hope you enjoyed The Foster Mother's Tale by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. I'll see you next time.